Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello everybody and welcome back to another Motorsport Magazine podcast. It's the 1st of October in a wet and horrible grey London, but we're going to cheer you up because we start the month with a very special guest. He's called Tiff Needell, and the older listeners among you will remember that he drove in Formula One. He did. He also has a book out, which is good fun. The younger ones listening will know Tiff as a television presenter. And he looks like one today. He looks like he's been in the Caribbean for about 2 months. Anyway, we'll be talking to him in just a moment. But with me, as usual, is Nigel Roebuck, our editor-in-chief, Ed Foster, our columnist and web editor, and, of course, the man himself, our editor, Damien Smith. He was about to go to Japan, lucky Damien. Anyway, he's with us today, and that's what matters. Let me tell you, first of all, about our latest subscription offer. It's all about saving money, of course, and you can save money on every edition of Motorsport when you subscribe. And this is the deal. You save 25% on the cover price when you subscribe for 24 magazines. You get a free luxury leather keyring worth £15. And you get priority booking and discounts for all Motorsport events, film evenings, and expert talks. It's a good deal. And just go to motorsportmagazine.com and you'll find all the details. Okay, I'll remind you at the end. Anyway, now this is good. So listen up. Jackie Stewart Reader's Evening. Why don't you join us for a very special night out with Jackie Stewart at the Landmark Hotel in Marylebone, that's in London, by the way, on Wednesday, December the 5th. Jackie Stewart with us, December the 5th, okay? We're putting together an exclusive evening for you, the Motorsport Reader, with the 3-time Formula One world champion. It'll include a drinks reception, it's always good, a 3-course dinner, and then a question and answer session with Jackie Stewart, Nigel Roebuck and Damien Smith. So that's worth the price of the ticket on its own, I'd say. We'll be announcing more exciting news for the 2013 Motorsport Hall of Fame on that very evening. Don't forget the Hall of Fame, beginning of next year. The tickets for this cost £120 for subscribers and £130 for non-subscribers. There's another reason to subscribe. To book your place for the Jackie Stewart evening, just go to our website, motorsportmagazine.com, or call 0044, that's for England, obviously, 0207 349 8472. 0044 from outside England, or just 0207 349 8472. I really hope we'll see lots of you there, because it's not often you can have your own evening with Jackie Stewart. Anyway, on we go. A lot happening, especially in Grand Prix racing at the moment. Everyone's talking about, what is it now? Perez has gone to McLaren. Hamilton's gone to Mercedes. No one knows where the hell Schumacher's going, do they? Yet? No? No, not yet. That's right. Now, Tiff, let's start with you, because you've come
on. Jake's gone to BT, don't forget.
Jake Humphrey's gone to BT. I know, yes. Yes, let's transfer the charges, shall we? No, Jake Humphrey, who presents the BBC Formula One programmes, will move over to BT Vision to present Premiership football. Okay, let's got that out of the way. wow, Formula One's different from when you had a flirtation with it. I mean, you weren't worried about how many millions, you were worried about qualifying.
I know, it's absolutely frightening. You know, I remember sort of rushing back from trying to get a Formula 2 driver at Nürburgring in my old rusty Ford Capri, you know, to get there to try and get the inside drive. And now it's your management team. It's not just a manager anymore, it's your management team. Talk to my management team. And it's very difficult as a young driver now, unless you've got millions behind you, to get anywhere. You know, you're buying test drives now to go up and down a runway for a year, you know, if you're lucky. So it's very strange. I wouldn't like to be there now, I don't think.
No, it's very different. I mean, Nigel, there's an awful lot of talk about money, isn't there? I guess it's always sort of been the way, but nowadays it seems to be more, money seems to be more the focus than almost anything else.
Well, it is, because, you know, there isn't much around, relatively. That's the thing. All the years I've been involved with it, there was a time when Formula One was much, much more low-key than it is now. But since it's been, you know, enormous in terms of sponsorship and TV coverage and everything else, there's never really been a time as acute as the one we're in now in terms of people looking for money.
But actually, I mean, you know the teams, you speak to the teams themselves. Aren't they frustrated? Wouldn't they prefer to have their own budget and just pick? Are they getting lazy? Are they sort of sitting back? I mean, we see these expensive motorhomes, we see the money they spend on marketing and promotions, and then they sort of want 3 or 4 million to choose a driver out of what, hundreds of millions. Are they not worried about this?
Well, it's in a very strange state these days. I mean, it was, I don't know how many years ago was Nicky, you know, talking about what he was paid and saying, you know, $1 million for driving and $5 million for PR or whatever, signing autographs in department stores. And, you know, I as Whitmarsh showed me in the current McLaren contract, there are three contracts. The last one of which joins the first two. The first two, one is driving and one is PR, public. And,
but surely with Whitbush,
as far as I understand it, the payment is literally 50-50.
But they're not taking Perez for money. McLaren,
they're
surely,
not, no,
are picking
no,
drivers
they're not taking
talent.
Perez for money, but on the other hand, you know, no one knows how long Vodafone are going to be around, and Perez does come with Carlos Slim, which is always, you know, to have the world's richest man backing you, it's, you know,
actually, I think
it doesn't go against you.
But no money will go to McLaren for this Perez deal.
No, but they'll get
no,
the sponsorship
not at this point, no.
off the back of it.
Yeah,
perhaps,
that's the point. I mean, if one day Telmex or something replaces Vodafone, then, you know, it'll all make
it
sense.
It would be sad, actually, wouldn't it, if we spent the podcast talking about money as well. Damien, give us your view on have they done the right thing? Perez at McLaren, Hamilton at Mercedes. Do you think that all makes sense?
I don't know. I think it does make sense, actually. The more I think about it, from Hamilton's point of view, as a long-term prospect, joining Mercedes has to be a good thing. And, you know, the key thing everyone's talking about, not only how much Simon Fuller and his company are going to make out of new deals, it's about 2014 new turbo rules. Mercedes are likely to be in a very good position come that season. We know how good Ross Brawn is when rules change. 2009 Brawn GP, for example. So I think as a sporting prospect, I think Lewis is probably going to be in a very good place. He would have been in a very good place at McLaren as well. So I think I think he found it very difficult to make this decision. That's why it's gone on as long as it has. I don't think it's something he's done lightly. But there's a really good David Coulthard column in the Daily Telegraph the other day, and he was talking about how at some point we all have to grow up and move away and do our own thing. And to an extent, Hamilton hasn't grown up. We've seen that countless times. He still acts like a teenager in his mid-20s. Maybe this will be the making of him moving to another team in a different set of circumstances.
Yeah, I think it's great he's moved. I think he was trapped in that sort of McLaren area, and I think it isn't going to be a breath of fresh air for him to be out in another team. And I think really we almost want more round. But the old days, 70s and 80s, people used to get bored with the team after 2 years and just go somewhere else to try another chassis, didn't they? And I think maybe we need a maximum time limit. You can only stay with one team for 5 years max or something.
Yeah. Well, on the other hand, it worked okay for Jim Clark, didn't it?
That's true, my hero.
Ed Foster, let's bring you in so we have a proper round table discussion. And also, you represent rather younger people, has to be said. Would you have done what McLaren and Mercedes have done from what you've seen of the last couple of seasons?
Yeah, I think the thing with McLaren is they're always up there, and Whitmarsh made a big point of saying all that after the announcement, and I think that's really true. And whether, you know, Mercedes hasn't really excelled in his time in Formula One in recent
certainly
years.
Certainly has not.
But then again, as Damien says, the new rules are looking much better. I think, personally, I think that the people that come off worst here are McLaren, because Hamilton is, in my view, the fastest driver in Formula One. And Perez may be brilliant, but is he ready to win a world championship next year? Probably not. And Button's great in a race, but his qualifying is nowhere near as good as Hamilton's. So I think they've lost out, personally, but that's just my opinion.
I agree. I think McLaren have been the losers in this.
That's interesting.
Okay. Yeah, I agree too. I agree too. Well, the only thing I would say, I think there are aspects of Lewis that certain people at McLaren absolutely will not miss. I mean, Lewis comes with a lot of baggage. That's the point. And I think if you look at 2011, I mean, there's been all this money. I mean, if I'd been Martin Whitmarsh at the end of 2011, I would probably ask for some money back from Lewis.
As you're talking about baggage, I think for safety, we only change rules, can't we, if it's safety. And I think when blinging garages is dangerous, they need to be in fireproof suits. And really, I think all supporters should be in motorhomes drinking wine and watching on the telly. It's too, I mean, with the fire in the Williams, you know, we can now say garages are dangerous areas and we shouldn't have hangers-on in there.
Let's ask you at this stage, because, you know, believe it or not, Tiff, a lot of people listening in right now will be enjoying hearing from you, because, let's be honest, you've been around a long time, OK?
It's not just Ed. I can represent my sons. They're 20 years. I am representing my sons. Therefore, I'm representing the younger generation as well.
OK, fine. But tell us a bit about the struggle that you had to even get into Formula One, which, let's face it, you did it, which is more than a lot of people have done, isn't it? Do you regret any of a lost opportunity here and there or not? Or was it everything it was cracked up to be when you finally...
No, but you always know things you could have done in the looking back which would have changed things. I should have phoned up Robin Hurd after I'd been starring in a march, whereas I thought Tolman's were going to take me, so I sat up back and didn't get my name around enough. I think the great thing about management and management teams now is they do speak to all the teams every week. You know, even if your driver's signed up for 2 years, you still keep in touch. Whereas when we were on our own with no managers, you know, I used to phone up team managers occasionally and say, here I am. But you didn't do it often enough, and if you weren't hanging around the Formula One, we used journalists. I mean, journalists were our biggest ally when we didn't have managers. So we were very much relied. I had Chris Whitty and Ian Phillips, yeah, of our mates with the Autosports, and they put my name forward to team managers. There was one wonderful case where I was in Formula Ford 2000 at Brands Hatch, the Racer Champions, and Chris Whitty had got Frank Williams to look at. He watched this Tiff Nadell. So I drove the race of my life, won by about 30 seconds. It was all damp, but I had a fantastic drive, Brands Grand Prix circuit. And when Chris said, you know, did you see that, Frank? He said, oh, some bloke pissed off into the distance. I got bored and went back to the van. And there was me every lap coming down past the paddock, you know, behind it, thinking, Frank's watching me. He was back at his motorhome. But it is that communication, a contact that was so hard. We just had to be brave, pick up the phone and dial the team manager's number.
Also, but when you got there, you had so little time to prove that you were capable of doing it. That's the other thing, isn't it? I mean, you've got... Okay, well, first of all, qualifying, you know. I mean, you've got to get through that, and if you don't... You know, but you people make quick decisions, don't they? Well, if you can't qualify, I mean, you know, forget it. That's
well, we just used to jump into the cars as well. You know, I mean, Villeneuve, great hero. You just jumped into cars. You didn't have time. All these kids now that said, I've only had 10,000 miles testing, you know, how could I prove myself? I'd had half a day at Donington, and then now I'm at Zolder, where I've never been around before, you know. And, you know, it's just so hard. The worst thing with me when I got my little chance was the fact that I knew the team were waiting for Jan Lemmers. And so all the time that I saw little conversations going on in the back of the paddock. So it was a pretty awkward time driving a car that was, you know, the back of the grid car anyway. But it was just brilliant that I got the one Grand Prix. It made such a difference to my own personal sort of feeling, just because, you know, I got to be one of the 24 talent alone. But it was a great time, but it was a strange... Actually, for the worst story about hanging around trying to get drives, I used to go to Daytona when the Formula One thing. I went to Daytona 24 hours to try and pick up an IMSA drive. So you used to travel stayed in James Weaver's room, my mate, you know, was racing. I remember looking for Tullius, the Jaguar team manager. And I still remember this day, the toilets in America. This is 1981, 82, around that time. The gentleman's sit downs didn't have doors. And I walked, I've been trying, you sort of used to stand on the edge of the paddock by a motor, waiting for a team manager to walk by so you could just, oh, hello, you know, bump into. And I went, and there was Tully sitting on the toilet. And I very nearly went up and asked him to talk to him.
Well, he wasn't going to go anywhere, was he?
But you see, maybe Perry McCarthy or someone would have still gone straight in and started chatting. Maybe that was my opportunity that I didn't talk to Tullius about driving for Group 44.
There must have been a point where you realised, hey, look, you know, I'm not going to win the Formula One World Championship, but I do want to drive racing cars. That was a sort of change of gear for you in a way, because ever since you've actually made a living out of it, which is pretty amazing, isn't it? Did you feel more comfortable in a way once that decision had been made? Okay, I'm going to go sports car racing, touring car racing, whatever it is, that's what I'm doing. I'm good at that. I can win. I can.
Well, you're never really comfortable because you're always looking at the better team that you wish you were in. That's always worse about racing driver because you always think, oh, I could do better if I was in that car. And we'll look at, you know, we've got right now Hamilton doing exactly that with his McLaren to think of a Mercedes in 2 years' time. So you never fully relax, even when you're enjoying it and getting paid money. Japan was fantastic. That's where I sort of made my professional breakthrough. Because there we had this little clique of gaijin racing drivers. And we all partied together and, you know, stayed in the same hotel. So that was very relaxing motorsport. But even then we were looking at the next season, looking at who had the money and looking for what team you might be able to swap over to. So you're never quite relaxed.
When did you... Sorry, Damien.
I was just going to say, well, what about this thing about how long you go on for as well? Because someone like you, you've raced, you know, almost all your adult life, you're still racing now.
Never retire. Well, the trouble is you need the millions. I think it's a bit easier to retire if you've got the Isle of Man to live on, or the, you know, but the Channel Islands as your home. So when you still need the money, you still race. And I suppose also the fact that I didn't really achieve as much as I'd love to have done in motorsport, that I still want to prove myself as a driver. Even now, when I go to Goodwood, I still want to, you know, want to put on a good show, I want to put on a good performance. And so that still drives me on. I think if I'd had 10 world championships, you know. But, you know, I look at Brian Redman's my heroes, David Hobbs, Derek Bell. They just lived this fantastic life. Mm. You know, I wish I'd been in their era. I'm jealous of them. I'm more jealous of them than I am of, you know, Damon Hill or any of the modern drivers, sure. Coulthard, Brundle. Hobbs, Redman and Bell. Just drove Formula 5000s, Targa, Florios, Nürburgrings. I mean, it was dangerous, but they just drove some fantastic and had a great life. You know, they just had a laugh. Yeah. They were earning fortunes, but they had a lot of fun.
Yeah, that's so true, actually, isn't it? When did you just... We'll come back to Formula 1 in a moment for those of you who would like us to go more down that road. But when was it you discovered, hey, I think I'm, you know, could be quite a good broadcaster as well, actually, and that would be a nice string to my bow because, you know, there's Top Gear, Fifth Gear, there's this, that, and when did that just occur to you over time?
No, my life has always been just stumbling by good fortune from winning a magazine competition to, you know, getting the Unipart. I'm a Unipart driving Formula 3 and turning professional, and the Durex scholarship. Little things just kept on happening, and I only did the Formula, the commentary I started first because I was just hanging around trying to get drives at race meetings when I was hauled in by the BBC to work alongside Murray, so my voice got on television. I never thought of television, I was just... Everything I was doing was really to enhance my driver's career. Yes. And then when they phoned up, because, you know, Chris Goffey broke his leg, so they want me to drive the Formula First racing car. So I thought, well, I'll do that. Didn't think anything of it as a career. It was just a day's work to get my name on the telly. So when that worked so well, it all just, you know, I got invited back to more and more television. But even then, I was still thinking of how it would help my racing career, not as a second career.
Yeah, they never give up, these guys. Let's come back.
I was
back
just
now.
Thinking about the Durex scholarship. Yes, I quite forgotten that.
it was a motor racing scholarship.
I know. Well, actually, the best break in my career was with Chris Hyatt Baker. My Formula 4 career was dying because I had the wrong chassis. I was borrowed a free chassis, totally out of money, finishing fifth and sixth and not getting anywhere. And I knew I had to have this decent chassis finding. Chris Hyatt Baker, this wild child, who was one of the original bungee jumping squad with the Dangerous Sports Club, jumped off the cliff.
Yes.
And he suddenly disappeared, bought the best chassis there was, this Cross T25F, but he never turned up that year. And anyway, I saw it advertised in the middle of the summer and phoned him up and said, "Hey, Chris, you know, can I buy your car but not pay you for it till I've sold it?" He said, "Yeah, far out, man. Yeah, come and pick it up." And if he hadn't have lent me that chassis, you know, I'd still be a civil engineer. Yeah. I mean, every time there's this good fortune, but that was probably one that was such a crunch time. And because I'd find out he was hang gliding. He'd given up Formula Ford racing because he discovered. I think he was smoking some funny smelling cigarettes at the time. And he found hang gliding was more his style, man.
But that's some pressure, isn't it? When you're driving a car that you've basically borrowed and said you'll pay for
when I sell it. Yeah.
So you can't crash. I mean, how do you commit to, you know, to a race when you've got that in the back of your mind?
Well, again, that's the interesting thing about kids now, the whole different driving style. We move around to circuits and ruining Spa and come. That's another whole story. But you know, when we drove, it was such a fine line between being fast and being crashed. And having run my own Formula Ford for 4.5 years on my own money, you know, I had to drive at like 98%. You know, Rupert Keegan was the first rich, wild kid. And he just went faster and crashed, went faster and crashed. Because he could afford it. Nowadays, the kids go faster, end up across the grass crete in a car park and realise they have to go a bit slower. But you know, I couldn't afford to cross that line.
It's a very good
point.
So
all the time, I was driving at 99% of my limit because I had to finish because I couldn't afford to hit anything. But that Crosley, I mean, again, getting the right chassis is important. Another awful thing about motorsport. Because one little statistic, I'd done 41 races at the Brands Hatch Club Circuit and never won. And then I got this Crosley, and I won 13 of the next 14 races on the trot. So you do have to have the right kit.
Never give up.
Even in Formula 4, never give up, no.
Actually, I think that brings us to something that's going on in Formula 1 right now, and which we were going to mention today anyway, which is some of the wild driving. I mean, obviously, Grosjean and Maldonado come immediately to mind. And, you know, is it your feeling that is partly caused by the fact that they have not had to drive, you know, on the verge of a crash because they've so far to go?
Well, very much so, yeah. They, you know, they find the limit now by exceeding the limit. When they exceed the limit, and there's no penalty for exceeding the limit. I do think the visibility, I think, you know, the head restraints now, they've got no peripheral vision. And I'm sure Grosjean thought the gap was there. When you see it on board, when he was going for the gap, and the rate at which he was going past Hamilton, I would have believed the gap would have been there. And I think he didn't appreciate how Hamilton suddenly got going and then was accelerating at the same speed as him. But by now, of course, he's lost that peripheral vision. He's not in the mirror because he's not far enough ahead.
Yeah.
So, you know, that peripheral vision's... If we talk about a head restraint, which would be horrible in a Formula One car, but almost if only those side hoops could have holes in them, you know, like the rear pillars of coupes, they have a little window. Mm-hmm. We almost need a peripheral vision to come back by having a see-through panel beside the helmet.
Well, actually, Nigel was writing in his column this very month about, you know, when are we going to have proper mirrors? And weren't you?
Well,
that
just seems to me to be absolutely absurd. We, you know, we live in an era literally preoccupied with safety. And yet for years and years and years, countless drivers have said to me that you can't see a thing out of the mirrors.
Aren't they quite good at the moment, though, or not?
No, not really. Grosjean brought that up again, you know, after the Spa accident. And you think, well, that is a fairly fundamental thing and a simple thing to put right, so why the hell don't they? You know?
But they're not only small, they're also so flimsy.
Yeah.
That they shake so much. Yeah. That actually, when you look from a driver's perspective at any speed whatsoever, it's just a blur.
It's distorted. No, that's true.
Perhaps they need to go on a driver awareness course, which I'm doing this coming Wednesday. I'll let you know. Let's move on one of Nigel's absolute favourite subjects, and that is Fernando Alonso. Because Nigel believes that he is by far the best driver in Formula 1.
He's by far the most complete.
Fine, that's fine.
Yeah.
Who's going to beat him? Can anyone beat him? What do you reckon, Damien?
I think Sebastian Vettel can beat him. Yeah, it's not over by any means. It's, you know, six races to go, and with the points structure the way it is, if Alonso has another non-finish, then it could all change. So, you know, historically, the last couple of years, Vettel and Red Bull finish the season strongly. We've got through Spa and Monza, which were two difficult circuits for Red Bull. Okay, Vettel fell into the Singapore win because of Hamilton's misfortune, but, you know, he was competitive. So I think, and the Ferrari isn't very competitive, particularly, you know.
No.
So there's a lot still to happen, I think.
Vettel's my man. I predict at the beginning of the season, I'm standing by my man as well. I mean, you put those two alternator failures
back on the scoreboard, and he's probably almost leading the championship. He's very unlucky with those two failures, whereas Alonso's only had the one suicide attack from Grosjean.
Yeah,
I think Vettel, I think Suzuka suits the Red Bull, but then Hamilton's going to be quick, isn't he?
Absolutely. I mean, I agree with Damien. I mean, I know Alonso's got a biggish lead at the moment, but I mean, you know, if your car is literally not able to compete, which, you know, on the strength of Singapore, you know, Alonso won that race 2 years ago. This time,
and Ferrari have never been good at Suzuka, have they historically?
No. Not particularly. No.
Not like McLaren.
No. So I mean, you know, if Red Bull are getting sort of even vaguely somewhere near close to where they were last year, then you know I think you know Damien's probably right. You can see Vettel winning it. In equal cars, I wouldn't take Vettel against Alonso, but they're not in equal cars.
If it was any other driver, I'd completely agree. But with Alonso, he's just always scoring points. You know, he might start from fifth on the grid, but he's just, at the end of the race, he's on the podium. You know, how did he manage that?
Yeah. Trouble is, you can't beat someone who wins a lot. If Vettel wins a lot...
Yeah, I mean, if Vettel wins every race, and even finishing third is not going to be enough, I don't think. My math isn't great. So we'll move on from that. But, you know, Alonso is always there, Grosjean. So, take him out.
If Vettel was to do it, hat trick of titles, how would we assess him, do you think?
Well, like it's just the way things fall into place, isn't it? You know, I mean, I was saying to someone the other day, if DRS had been introduced one race earlier than it was, last race of 2010 rather than first of 2011, you know, Vettel wouldn't have been world champion, because Alonso would have got past Petrov without even at that dump of a circuit.
There's a lot of if my aunt was my uncle here, isn't there?
Would have got past Petrov, you know, without too much bother, and that would have settled the championship.
So I think the trouble is with drivers nowadays, this is the shame that they don't do Le Mans saloon cars, because that's what gave us to be able to judge Moss and Clark, because we could see them in similar cars, you know, or in other forms of motorsport. Because now all we really know now is that Alonso's better than Massa, Hamilton's faster than Button, and Vettel's better than Webber.
We can't really
find out who's the best of those three unless we finally get two of them in the same team one day, which is highly unlikely.
And also, wouldn't it be such great, you know, wouldn't it be great fun? Because, I mean, we remember, don't we, us older chaps, watching all those races with Jimmy Clark in a Cortina. I mean, you go on and on, you name it. It'd be wonderful to see that again. I mean, we're not going to, but you're so right, actually, because we don't know much. We don't know, actually, who is the greatest.
So you get the race of champions each year when you suddenly see Sebastian Loeb. Is he perhaps the greatest driver on the planet? You know, how do we compare now? Because Loeb gets into those
I can remember Kovalainen walking it, though, 1 year, Tiff. That's
true.
He's a good driver, but...
Yeah, that's a good point.
But to answer the editor's question, I would be very disappointed if Vettel took a third championship. And I believe that Mr. Ecclestone has gone on record as saying that he doesn't want Vettel to win a third championship. And obviously he doesn't, because it gets boring as far as television viewing is concerned. Well, I mean, it does. And so I'd like to see Alonso win the world championship. But actually, I think, and I'll shut up in a second, I think Lewis Hamilton's going to win the world championship.
I feel you're right. I'd like to see the Ferraris. Well, everyone loves Ferraris.
Yeah.
We want to encourage Ferraris, don't we?
It'd be a painful pill to swallow for McLaren if they gave the number one to Mercedes next year, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would. I mean, it's happened before. I mean, Prost took number one from McLaren to Ferrari.
Well, inherited off Brawl. In fact, they inherited off what is now Mercedes. So, why are they just giving it back? They got given one when they got Button. So now it's a bit of a swap, really, isn't it? If he does take number one the other way.
He's telling Ron that.
Given the Ryder Cup comeback we saw over the weekend, I mean, you know, in sport, you can't rule anything out. Lewis isn't out of it by any means.
No, he's not.
No, he certainly isn't.
And
you can bet anything that McLaren will give him everything to win the championship. That's the thing about McLaren, is there'll be no change in their attitude on the track in dealing with him. Might be a bit frosty in the motorhome this weekend, but in terms of the actual stuff on track, he'll get everything he needs.
I think we ought to ask Tiffany Dell what he feels about Michael Schumacher, because how can I put this politely? There comes a time, Tiff, in all drivers' careers where they really probably ought to stop. And I'm wondering whether you feel that that would be a good idea for Michael or not.
No, I love Shuey. I wanted him to win one more race. Oh, I don't think he's quite obviously got the speed he had. He qualifies. So it's amazing his race. He's bad, isn't he? The first 10 laps of a race nowadays.
Sort of driving into people without.
Well, yes, that was weird. I must admit, the Mercedes come out with any sort of possible reason. I mean, he wouldn't have made the corner, let alone, he would have been in the
host. Well, on the radio was saying, what were you doing?
What was that all about?
Yeah. It could be the eyesight. I know eyesight goes in the dark. The first time your eyesight goes when you get to 40 plus, is night driving. You suddenly notice, and it could be.
And it's happened to him in Singapore before.
Yeah, in the dark.
Exactly the same thing.
There's no doubt your eyesight begins to go at 40. How old is he now?
He's 44 in January.
Yeah, so I wouldn't be surprised if it was an eyesight thing.
I don't go out at night anymore. It's terrifying.
I tell you what, you're doing a course, is it, then, Ross?
Something about you that strikes me actually is as recently as Spa, my German friends in the press room are all saying, no, Michael's going to go on,
German people are saying.
People who know him well are saying, no, he's not going to start.
With Sauber.
But at the time, everybody was assuming he was going to stay with Mercedes. And I wonder if Michael had made up his mind, say, 3 months ago, I'm going to go on. I wonder if the whole Lewis thing would ever have come up.
Yeah, kick Rosberg out. Rosberg, quite seriously, a huge shock.
Quite seriously, because... it would have been. It's quite a difficult thing actually to boot Michael Schumacher out if you're Mercedes. It's not without risk. So the fact that he still hasn't made up his mind, I guess did they reach a point of thinking, well, we've got to do something, because supposing he decides in November he's not carrying on, then what?
I don't want him to go anywhere else. I mean, he has to retire now.
Right. You wouldn't be happy to see him at Sauber, or is it?
No.
That's just...
He has to be in a winning, winning team. Or Sauber, you can't say it's not a winning, potentially winning team at a long chalk. But maybe win one of the last few races. I think Brazil suits Shuey. Fast, high-speed, old Mercedes. Shuey to win at Brazil and then retire.
I'd love to see him at Sauber, I have to say.
You would,
yeah.
But just in the midfield, barging around with Kobayashi.
Well, that's what he's doing at the moment.
Schumacher.
His racecraft midfield's questionable. So yeah, it would be entertaining. But his whole comeback has been tilting at windmills. It's guy really up against it all the way through, really. And I love the fact that he's still got the spirit in him that he just can't give it up. And the idea of him being in a Sauber and putting in the odd cameo performance like Perez has, where he's suddenly been on the right strategy at the right time and has been a genuine front runner at times.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
This year. Schumacher.
Actually, it was quite funny. I was in a bar in Nice when at Monaco, the qualifying, and I forget who was on pole just before Shuey. Someone, and the bar sort of, a lot of people cheered. But when Shuey set that time, the whole pub just didn't. Really? I couldn't believe the support he still has. I thought it was a bit 50-50. It's not anti-Schumacher people. In that bar, when the telly, when he did that lap time,
everyone was
erupted.
It's funny, short memories, isn't it? Do you remember when he was barging around with Damon Hill? That you'd never have had a bar erupt like that. And now I think people see him as a sort of rather venerable character of Grand Prix racing.
It's just a shame he keeps blotting his copybook. But you're happy to see him go, Nigel. You think he should go now?
Well, I can't. The point is, he's not going to be any better next year than he was this year, is he? That's the thing. He's 44 next year, and you sort of think,
well, why are you doing this? And I remember the three years were after he'd been pushed out by Ferrari, when he was still coming to the races occasionally with Ferrari, and talk about a lost soul. I mean, you've never, ever seen... I remember, I think we were in Barcelona or somewhere, and I watched him walk the entire length of the paddock, quite alone. Nobody went near him, not a photographer, not nobody.
Good shot, that.
And he just seemed absolutely bored and lost. And I think, quite honestly, that's much more than for most racing drivers. That's going to be Shuey's big problem. I think he fundamentally does not want to do anything but drive cars.
But talk about lost causes. On the back row of the last ETM race, Coulthard and Schumacher, Ralph, qualified behind Susie Wolf, on the back of the... What are those two doing, embarrassing themselves in DTM?
Making money?
Well...
I don't know. No, I agree. I think it's sad.
Yeah, but
actually,
they've got enough money. Whereas my case, I would be happy to be on the back row and earning another couple of grand.
No.
But David doesn't need to be there, nor does Ralph.
No, I know.
I agree with you entirely. And you'd think it would distress them, wouldn't you? You think
they would.
Has he signed up for another year, David? Or sure, hopefully not.
I'm not sure, actually. Maybe not. But on the other hand, you know, it's... Some people, they can't let go of racing completely. And I think Michael would... If Michael goes from Formula 1, I don't think we'll ever see him in anything else. But a lot of drivers do, like Lacey did, DTM and that sort of thing. And Mika, even, hang around, because it's a difficult thing to let go of a whole way of life.
Just what they do, isn't it?
Yeah.
The shame is really that sports car racing is not in a very good state, because obviously there aren't many seats... No. To go do Le Mans and that sort of thing, where Coulthard and Ralph would probably be very good at. And there's only really the two teams, and so there's not enough seats there. So the only other thing is DTM, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and also, you know, sports car racing probably doesn't pay the sort of money that would, you know, that would...
But they're not doing it for the money, surely, those two.
I'll tell you what, it's no easy option these days. If you do get a top drive in sports cars, you get found out pretty quick if you're not up to it, because you know, they're running a proper... Grand Prix pace these days.
Yeah. You know, and you see Davidson's accident, and it's not either something you're going to go into lightly, is it?
Absolutely.
And it's
not,
interesting. Yeah. Michael's always said, "I'll never go to Le Mans. Forget it. Not interested. Too dangerous."
Because he can't see it. No, that's why.
You're listening to the Motorsport Magazine podcast with our panel: Nigel Roebuck, Ed Foster, Damien Smith, and our special guest, Tiffany Dell. And Tiff, we've got to ask you today, or I've got to ask you anyway. Jake Humphrey is leaving the BBC Formula One programme to go to BT Vision. A chance for you?
Oh, I don't think so, Rob. No, I was knocking on the door for a long time, but I think nowadays the front man is more of the independent from another sport, you know, BBC presenter. So I think it's very unlikely you'll have a motorsport face fronting the show. Unfortunately, you've still got Eddie, but there we go. But again, David's great at that, but it'll probably be, I think, more likely an in-house sort of BBC front person.
Okay.
What's the pressure of working in TV like compared to being a racing driver?
It's a doddle. Yeah. Just stand up there, say what you think.
Yeah.
No, it's you know, I enjoy television a lot because it is nice and it's quite relaxing. But I mean, I think when I have to talk about testing cars and come up with clever storylines, I struggle a bit with the script or come up with... I'll say, this car's nice. Clark's will come up with some wonderful hyperbole or something. I'm struggling a bit. My civil engineering didn't teach me very good English. But they're fronting TV shows that I love doing. That I'm doing some powerboat racing at the moment, who's circuit racing for Sky, and I enjoyed doing that sort of thing very much.
Was it John Watson who in this Future Motorsport article was saying that he actually loves live TV because it gives the same sort of adrenaline and pressure as racing used to give him? Was it John Watson?
Yeah,
was it?
That's right. He does say that.
When we go filming, I mean, a fifth gear item, there's only myself, cameraman, sound man, and a director. And it's like going to for the race meetings. Your director's your team manager, and your cameraman's your mechanic and a sound man. And you're a little team of four going off into the hills with a track and getting a result in one day. It's like a one-day job. Sure. So there is that buzz and adrenaline, and it does pump you up.
Well, but certainly live does, that's for sure. And, you know, you can't get it wrong because it's gone out.
I must say, this year I've thought about that with Jake and DC and even EJ. Are the races the Beaver's not actually transmitting live? I wonder. I mean, I know they've
spoken to them, and they say, well, they just behave as if it were going out live, yes, live and all the rest of it, which is obviously what you would have to do. But I wonder if it is quite the same.
It's not, no. But I think the thing is, you've got to, because it's the only way you can keep the excitement up, isn't it? And the
sound genuine, I suppose.
Sure. Okay. Let's finish talking about Formula One with just a mention of the Williams team, because Tiff, I think, if a cheer goes up for Schumacher in the bar, if Williams win another race, the roof will blow off. But people love this team still, don't they? And yet they've got this bloke who keeps crashing it, and
he doesn't keep crashing.
He gets bumped
into other people occasionally. It's not all his fault. Pastor, I love Pastor. Ever since he thumped a marshal at Monaco, didn't he? I thought that's the sort of racing driver we need. And he was banned for a year. It wasn't even racing. Was that Formula 3000 or was it GP2? It was way back. GP2, early GP2. Yeah. I'm a big Pastor fan, and obviously I'm a Williams. Anyone that takes a Williams to the checkered flag is my hero anyway, because Sir Frank is just the old-fashioned motorsport that's still going. He does it because he loves the sport, and you know, I've met him a lot of times. Nearly did some test driving for him once, but of course he loaned me the car when I drove at Donington. Only what, 2005? I drove a Williams BMW Grand Prix car around Donington with an item on fifth gear with me racing Vicky in a BMW M5. So, you know, only Williams would lend a 50-something-year-old journalist, you know, a Grand Prix car at my age. You know, to drive around that, I was like 178 miles an hour around the Rockingham Wall and into the chicane. And it was a wonderful moment. And only Sir Frank would do that. And he actually phoned me. This was a lovely story, actually, because it was the day after I did it. I was driving home and my son phoned me up. And says, a bloke called Frank Williams phoned Dad to talk to you. And I said, yeah, you know. I think it was a drive going by that time. Or somebody said, you're probably after a drive. No, don't be silly. So I was on the road. I thought, I'll sort it out tomorrow when I get home. I was driving home that night, and the mobile went in the car. And it's, hello, Tiff, this is Sir Frank Williams. And I just wanted to phone you to say what an outstanding piece of television that was last night. But it showed the difference. It was the first time I was seeing, because we had a helicopter shot of the acceleration. Both me and Vicky were both doing 70 miles an hour for rolling start, and we both just floored it. And Sir Frank just said, you know, just that visual image of the difference in speed of a Grand Prix car. And this was, having left a message at home with my son, he still, instead of waiting for me to call back, tracked down my mobile phone number and phoned me up to thank me for what a wonderful... So yeah, Pastor Maldonado, hero.
Right. So that's a good story.
No, I'm a Maldonado fan. I mean, there are times when I think he maybe should be allotted his own personal steward. But and he does get involved in things. But Tiff's right. You know, it's by no means always his fault. I mean, I thought the thing with Perez at Silverstone, for instance, I thought that was ridiculous.
Yes, okay, I agree.
Was just, if ever there was a pure racing incident, you know, that was it. And I thought Perez made an absolute meal of it. But that probably goes back to the incident at, you know, at Monaco in practice when...
We're all huge fans of Williams, aren't we? I mean, what I'd like to see very much is Valtteri Bottas in the car as a race driver. That's what I want to see.
Well, he will be. Surely that's virtually an ink job, isn't it?
You would assume so. But it is a matter of, it isn't in the end.
He's not exactly minted, is he?
He's not, no, that's
but
the
I
problem.
But I thought his sponsors have got shares in Williams, I understand.
Really? Silence.
Oh, really?
Yes, I thought they had...
Well, you may well be
past
right.
Past the action, that's what I'd read somewhere.
Fine.
Oh, well, anyway, in that case,
I think he'll be very exciting.
Yeah, I agree.
Nigel, I'm intrigued to see how you think Perez will fit in a McLaren.
I think he'll probably have to. There is a perception in the paddock that Perez is extremely talented, but perhaps not quite as good as he thinks he is. In other words, not that he won't be in the end, but he certainly doesn't. You know,
I think he'll fit in very well because he's not an ego, is he? He's quite a quiet, unassuming.
He has sort of arrived almost like Piquet Jr. did, in the sense that I don't really have to do anything because it's all mapped out for me. You know, I'm going to go here, and then I'll, you know. Mm-hmm. And the perception had always been, of course, that eventually he would, you know, finish up in a Ferrari. So I find that aspect of it intriguing actually now, because Montezemolo said no, he's not ready yet for a Ferrari drive. Maybe, you know, that was what he genuinely felt. But I wonder if Ferrari are thinking...
Massa stays again.
Well, yeah, I mean, but it's... It is a matter of, you see, so much is predicated on what happens the year after, because the rumours still persist that in 2014 Vettel will be at Ferrari. So to a degree, that's always been, you know, what's been talked about. Well, they're really only looking for what somebody just for 1 year.
Well, put someone in for 1 year, put a youngster in.
Well, but of course, they certainly did try to do a deal with Mark Webber. Hard. They really.
But that's going backwards. Really Ferrari, that. But it's pretty young but, Italian.
But just for 1 year, you see, it's.
Yeah, well, what's the other problem they've got is Alonso loves Massa being his teammate.
Well, yeah, yeah. Of course, like, but yeah, absolutely, so. Yeah.
Okay.
It's true. I mean, I mean, if it were me, I would, if I were Ferrari, I would put Hülkenberg in it.
Hülkenberg.
Yeah.
Sorry, I forgot about that one. Yes.
Good, or
good spot.
Well, I've interviewed Joe Ramirez, who is Mexican and who used to run the McLaren team, and without giving too much away, he's very interesting about Perez, actually. And one thing he did say was that he felt that it would be a mistake for him to go to Ferrari, because he felt that where he is right now in his career, to be number two, which he would be to Alonso, would be a mistake. And he's pleased that did not happen. So that's quite, you know, as Ed intimated just now, there does seem to be a feeling, even if it's not in the contract, that Alonso, you know, must win the race. Well, I mean, with Massa, it's a given, but...
Well, it's not going to do Perez much harm if he follows Alonso around,
no.
Is it, surely?
Okay, no.
Even
well,
if he has to. I mean, he can out-qualify him and drop behind him. Loves that everybody knows you're number two. I'd never see... What is the harm of being number two to one of the greatest drivers?
Because I think... Well, you think of Sterling following Fangio. It didn't ever bother him.
No, exactly. No. Peterson following, you know,
Andretti. Mario, yeah, yeah. Exactly. No. Yeah.
This is a ridiculous concept that being a number two is a problem.
I think his opinion was that it's not good for their confidence, for their head, if they're constantly being asked to, you know, give way or slow down or whatever it may be.
If it's constantly, he's going to have a big contract from somewhere else if he's constantly being asked to let Alonso pass.
Yeah,
it's not good for them. They've been pampered all the way and looked after all the way to the top.
It's a good debate.
Yeah, so you put Hülkenberg before Di Resta then as a choice of driver.
I think it's six of one, isn't it? I mean, it is. It's almost impossible to draw any distinction between them, which is actually bad luck on both of them, because to some degree they are quite difficult to rate, because they, you know, are they both absolutely exceptional, or are they both very good? Or
it's a Rosberg situation, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, personally, I think they are both. Potentially.
Both better than Rosberg. You think Hamilton, I believe, will blow Rosberg away.
Yeah, but on the other hand, everybody thought Lewis would blow Button away when he first went there.
Agree,
so it doesn't always work. It doesn't always work out that way. I mean, I think Lewis will be quicker than Nico, because I think Lewis is quicker than anybody, full stop. But, you know, that isn't the whole thing, is it? I mean, I thought, you know, Rindt was quicker than Stewart, but I still thought Stewart was better than... more complete than Rindt.
Yeah.
That's why, if you talk to Jay Wyers, that's why Jay Wyers reckons, will always put Prost ahead of Senna. He said, yeah, Senna was quicker, but Prost was...
flawed. Know. I'm not flawed. I mean, Senna was flawed.
Senna
yeah, Prost
was, flawed,
was complete.
Yes,
yeah.
I'm proud,
Prost well, if you'd like
complete,
to join us in the pub, we'll be there for the next 3 days discussing. discussing, yeah, so do come along anytime you like. I'm sorry to break that one up, guys, but we do have readers' questions for Tiffany Dell, and if we don't ask you these questions, it's utterly pointless for the readers asking them. So the first one, Tiff, comes from Niels Roberts, and he wants to know about what he calls your fantastic third place in the Alpha 962 at Le Mans in 1990, which was a big deal for you, obviously.
Absolutely, was the greatest achievement really that I did in motorsports. But you know, that was the best thing about it. We were the only privateer in the top six. It was one of those Le Mans, one of the most competitive ever. We only beat him by the two works Jaguars. We had the factory Porsche right behind us, and then the factory Nissan, and then the factory Toyota. And we just came this little team from Japan. And literally Gary Cummings, who was an old Kramer mechanic, I think, had rebuilt the car on his own in Japan for like a month. It was the first year of the chicanes, and I'd worked out that the length of the Fuji straight was the same length as the new three parts of the Mulsanne. And we bought the factory Porsche rear. They said it was a low downforce track still. But we tested the low downforce against our own high downforce. Then we got made our own little rear wing element, which we added. So we went there with our own little plan to run our wing up in the air for the new chicanes, and didn't qualify well because we didn't have the qualifying engines and we couldn't run the boost or anything. So we qualified 20th, and then we just battled, and we had this plan of sort of just doing single stints. We didn't have a trainer, we didn't have any dietitians. So me and Reed had said, we'd like to, Derek Bell was my co-driver in Japan. We'd lost him to the factory team. Of course, he was the one that finished one behind me. And we just started single stinting, driving flat out, because by now Le Mans was already a sprint, you know, back then. And we thought we'd double stint in the night, but it just seemed to be going so well. And the whole theory was, you double stint, you get very tired, and then it takes a long time to recover. But we could go the 50 minutes and be only half tired and never feel too knackered. And even through the night, we just sit and we single stinted the entire race.
Remind us who you were driving with.
Anthony Reed and David Sears. Mm. Anthony had come in as the third driver in Japan because I'd got him in. I kept on getting young British drivers like myself into drives, like James Weaver I got to drive in Japan, you know, and then I've got Anthony Reed to drive. And then I got David Sears was out of a job, so we got him in as the third British driver. And it was just a fantastic, nothing went wrong with the car. We had a cracked windscreen and that was it. And just did the whole thing flat out. Didn't even take the top off, didn't put any oil in. And that was down to Gary Cummings virtually building the whole car. He did some modifications as well. There were some bits that the factory team had problems with that we didn't, because Gary had seen it and modified it. So it was just a tiny little team, a little Japanese mechanics running around, not speaking any English at all, with Gary shouting at them in his big American, get the car out of the pits! And it was just, there was a French pit signalers down at the last year, I think almost, of the Great Mulsanne pits. Because when Brun broke down, I mean, it was so sorry for them, really. Well, I wasn't sorry at all, actually. No, I wasn't. Why'd I say that? And I remember coming round the mills and look at my pit wall, and they were all flapping, and I didn't know what the problem. I was the only person in the world that didn't see poor old Siggy's car parked up. So I didn't even know that we got up to third with, what, about three laps to go after 23 hours and 45 minutes. So it was just a dream come true, and just a fantastic little team takes on the works and almost wins. And both the Jaguars had quite major problems. One crashed, I think, in the early hours, and one had some leaking water. So they weren't trouble-free, the two that beat us.
And the car didn't use any oil. Is that, are you serious?
Yeah, no oil.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Just drove it flat out, the three of us.
Fantastic. Wonderful. It was a great achievement. That's a good question. Thank you, Niels. And a good answer, of course, naturally. This one comes from Ben Dunnell. And I hope that's right, Ben. Dunnell. Anyway, yeah. How close did you get, Tiff, to the Audi seat that went to John Bincliffe in 96?
It was mine. I don't know what went right. This was actually a weird thing. I always thought being on Top Gear and being the television star would help me get drives. But because, and I actually did this on purpose, when I drove that very first Formula First, having seen, you know, drivers on telly, the public sitting there, oh, that look easy, just turn the corner, out the corner, down the straight, I can do that. So literally on that first time, I deliberately started sliding it sideways on the opposite lock, which is now my little trademark, I guess, because I thought it'd make it look exciting. Yep. And of course, the more I did that in racing cars on television, the more team managers thought, well, he's driving, you know, that's not the way to drive fast. And I think in a way it almost backfired that now as a television presenter, tarting about on telly, therefore I wouldn't be a serious team member. Of course, Audi is very much the German team and serious and you're a great works driver. Sure. And I think that was Audi UK was sort of putting forward my name. I only saw Dr. Early. That was one of those awful me on my own speaking to somebody poor. I was down in South Africa, where they had that touring car where the British drivers went down. And I had an awful car, and I was qualified down the back. A year before I was on the front, this time I was down the back. And during this bad weekend I was having as a driver, I finally, you know, said to Dr. Ulrich, hello, but I got a very hello, yeah, that was it, you know. That was one of those interesting, I didn't think that worked well. That's what I needed, a journalist or a team management company saying, Doctor, this is a hotshot boy and he's on telly and he can drive, and yes, he looks like he's driving idiots on television, but he can drive a car. And that would have been a lovely drive to have had.
Yeah,
right. And I thought I was close. And then the Ford, exactly the same thing, the Mondeo drive. I was quickest when they tested all the drivers for that, but all of a sudden, I think there was some dealing going on, and I didn't get that one either. Never mind.
But it did become your trademark, and I do understand absolutely that could have been some kind of problem. But actually, nowadays, when you race at the Revival, so does Anthony Reed, and you both put on a fantastic show. And of course, you know, there's a place for that.
Yes, well, the old cars had to be driven that way. Right, they went sideways anyway. So I guess the style that I put on telly would have suited the olden days. In fact, my whole racing career almost tripped up when they stopped cross-ply tyres. Because driving styles did change dramatically. Because in 78, when I was a star in at Hockenheim in a Formula 2 car in a March BMW with cross-plies that suited my style amazingly, I then tested the Tolman on the very first Pirelli radials at Mugello, which I'd never been around before, which is the most wonderful track.
Yeah.
And I was useless. I mean, I couldn't get used to this weird... You couldn't put any slip angle on radials. So, you know, 10 degrees sideways and you spun. So it was a shock to me. It didn't suit my driving style at all, radial tyres. And that's very much since then, you know, understeering cars have been the way to go. When you added the ground effect to radial tyres, that multiplied the problem because now you're on rails. Yeah. You know, slip angle wasn't to be tolerated at all. You know, the early days of those Mercedes Group C cars, people were spinning up the road like tops on the radial tyres.
Actually, I think...
Because you couldn't, so, you know... I like the old-fashioned way. We said on cross plies, I could have been a star.
That surely is the quote of the day, isn't it? On cross plies, I could have been. Yeah. No, but seriously, I think this is the most interesting point, which is unfortunately right at the end of the show, because it does, in my view, throw some light on all the stuff we've been hearing in very recent Formula One about I can't drive on these tyres. I mean, you know, that's quite interesting to me that you've heard drivers say over the past couple of seasons, it's the tyres, I can't...
Well, you know, Villeneuve always said, if you lose time by going sideways, there is something wrong with motor racing.
I couldn't agree
more. And I agree with that entirely. There's a wonderful picture of Chris Amon at Alton Park, at Old Hall, in fact, in the Ferrari in 68, in the most glorious...
My favourite photo ever.
But, you know, and I remember talking to Chris about that, and he said, yeah, but, you know, it wouldn't be possible to do that now.
No.
And you made just the point you did. It's cross-plies. Yeah,
that's what he's saying, and I think it may have been the a problem for you in your career, but I think it was a problem for the whole sport. I mean, I do find now, and I know a lot of people feel the same as I do, is that the spectacle. Yes, it's exciting, the Hamilton, will he win, etc., Vettel, but the spectacle is not what it was because the cars look.
Too easy.
It's interesting now, isn't it, that the you know, if somebody gets even a couple of inches out of line coming out of a chicane or something, the commentary team is sort of, whoa, you know, wow, you know,
what a
crossed
huge
up
moment.
There, wow, yeah. Yeah. And, you know, and at one time, it was like that. And in fact, we're talking about Eamon in the Ferrari. You know, you could watch that all day. It didn't matter.
Absolutely.
They weren't overtaking constantly. Absolutely. It didn't matter because you could just watch that.
I always remember going to a friend of my house in South Africa, in Johannesburg, Graham Duxbury's dad, and he had an old cine film. And he went to the test day, you know, in the mid-70s at Lurkop, the famous, this crested corner onto the straight, which just, it was a corner that just promoted oversteer. And he just sat there filming as Stewart, and it was the sort of early, I think he was in the early Tyrrell, about the first Tyrrell that year, whatever that was. You could just watch this film because they were all coming through Lurkop on these wonderful balanced power slides.
Yeah.
Whereas now one car going through a corner doesn't do anything for you.
I used to love them watching coming out.
But we mustn't talk like old farts. It's not just Ed that's representing. Ed, can we have Ed as you represent? But what did you say? As you represent the youth of today, Ed, what do you think about this?
Well, I'd be interested to hear, when, you know, talking about all this, how did you get on with the Williams cyber, with the Williams BMW? When you drove that at Rocky.
Well, I just hung on to that. I wasn't driving it. I think it was sort of driving me. Actually, the one thing I never told Williams was I'd never driven a racing car with left foot braking in my life. And I slid down to the cockpit and found these two big buckets, one for each foot. And suddenly realised, I've got a brake with my left foot. And the one thing, of course, everybody, all the former GP2 drivers said, as soon as they drive a Grand Prix, they can't believe the braking. So I went out rocking and thinking I was going to have this fantastic braking down to the hairpin, press the brake with the left foot. And hardly anything happened. I kept overshooting, out braking. And once when I really brake too late, you're accelerating so fast. That's the point about a Formula One car. You don't reach a top speed and then peak out so you can look at your braking marker boards coming up. You're always accelerating. Mm. And once I just sort of missed the point I was thought I'd brake at, so I panicked with my left foot and actually pressed properly for the first time after 3 hours. And the thing just stopped with 4G. And I suddenly realised that my whole left leg, of course, they only ever press clutch pedals.
Yeah.
And I'd never pressed the left foot down hard. Yeah.
So now I know, well, they have to be pretty fit with their left legs, because they do need to put a lot of weight on them. But yeah, that was impressive. But no, they had a couple of little twitches and slides, you know, because, you know, they still come alive at lower speeds. But of course, you've got to kill the slide immediately. You've got to instantly stop any movement. You can't let it go and hold it there. Meanwhile, so going back to your opinion, though, on, you know...
Meanwhile, what does Ed Foster think about...
Yeah. Well, no, I, sliding is the, you know, is what you want to see. That's why Revival is so great, and the St Mary's Trophy race is just brilliant when you get proper drivers in these old cars, and you see them, you know, minis in a four-wheel drift, and, you know, the first corner at Goodwood, I stood down there last year and watched the minis go through there, and every time one came in, you think, it's going to crash. No, it didn't. It's going to crash. No, it didn't. And it was, you know, I watched it just solidly. It was brilliant. I loved it.
So more Maldonado, more Grosjean. They're going to crash. Yeah. That's all we need.
Shall we leave it there?
You think they're going to crash, and they usually do, though. That's yes, the difference. Okay.
Actually, Tiff, before we end, did you ever see Jimmy in a Los Cortina?
Oh, yes. Yeah, clinging to the railings. I've got my own little box camera photos. Yeah.
I mean, you could watch it all day, couldn't you?
Yeah, wheel up in the air, smile on his face.
And you'd be standing at the sort of exit of Clearways, or sort of halfway through Clearways, and he'd be setting it up for the corner coming under the bridge, you know. It was just glorious.
And you were close. That's the other thing about spectating. You're a car park away. You don't get that feel. You're Crystal Palace. I was on the fence. You're looking into Ronnie Peterson's cockpit in a Formula 3 car. And that passion of being close, the noise, the wind, you know, you can see things. Well,
that's the thing that's changed for me, is the circuits more than... I think modern cars can still be spectacular if you get the right corner to watch them at. But there are fewer good corners where you can get close. Mm. And the thing about Goodwood... that always reminds me every year, is you're watching cars without any catch fencing between you and the cars, which these days feels really odd, because
there's
nowhere else you get that.
You're watching it as it was when you were watching it.
I'm looking forward to Austin, because Anthony Davidson has done the Mercedes simulator, Austin. He says it is unbelievable. He said trust me, he said the whole Formula One world is going to say this is a new circuit like we haven't seen for years and years.
But my only concern is, again, the Tilke thing. From turns like 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, which a driver will love because it's all very high speed, but the guy behind will drop a second away because you've got lots of consecutive high speed corners. Then when you get to the straight with the DRS, he's going to be too far behind to overtake. What was the last new circuit again they loved? China, no.
The most recent Indian one.
Hasn't that got incredible high speed down towards... There's a big loopy corner at the top and then a fantastic section which all the drivers loved. By the time they got to the start finish straight, the guy behind was always a second behind because he can't follow in the dirty air. We got too many corners.
Well, apparently at Austin, the corner that's going to make the track is turn one, which is fairly tight, but very, very wide. And the belief is there will be any number of lines.
I would say the only way is, isn't it China with a stop hairpin at the end of the straight? The only way to get proper overtaking with a very tight hairpin where they go up the inside and they cut back up the inside again.
They've got one in Malaysia as well.
But do you remember the fantastic racing they always used to have at Cleveland when they had an IndyCar race at Cleveland? And that was an airport circuit, but extremely wide, and there were countless different lines.
Sorry, guys, but we're going to have to pretty much wrap it up now. And we've got a question from Jeff Hall. Otherwise, we're going to leave Jeff Hall out, which seems a bit naff. And very quickly, Tiff, Jeff is suggesting that you dislike Lewis Hamilton because you never say that he's had a great drive.
What on my tweets is this, probably? I always expect Hamilton to be brilliant. So he's not brilliant. He doesn't get a... I know what you mean. It's sort of expectations you have of each driver. So if someone like Maldonado wins, it's sort of exciting because you hadn't expected it. But Lewis, he doesn't. You're right. Somehow he doesn't inspire me, and I don't know why he doesn't inspire me, and I can't put my finger on it, even though I agree he's the quickest driver on the grid.
Yes, he doesn't... he's not... incredibly lovable right now, is he, Lewis?
I mean, the fact he was so manufactured, you know, watching through all the formula he came up, you know, with the McLaren money, paying for 2 years of Formula Renault, 2 years of Formula 3, 2 years of GP2, season testing Formula 1 cars. And you sort of, you knew it was coming all the time. Therefore, when he does brilliance, you sort of, we knew that was going to happen.
Oh, you just can't win, eh? Anyway, All right, well, thank you very much, Tiff.
My pleasure. Thanks
thank
for inviting
you.
Me.
It's good fun. And I hope you've all enjoyed it out there, and even the Old Farts Reminiscing Club, which took over for a while. But, hey, you know, it is Motorsport Magazine, and, I mean, that's what Motorsport Magazine is partly about, of course, is enjoying the past and appreciating the past and learning from it, looking forward as well. So that's all good. Thank you very much for joining us, everybody. We'll be back, won't we, Ed? We'll be back with another podcast, probably either at the end of this month or the beginning of the next one.
Well, there's a special coming up with John Surtees, because we've got our readers' evening. Yeah. As we speak now, it's tomorrow evening, so that'll be coming up shortly. We're recording that one. That's Nigel and I talking to John in company with our readers, a selection of, which we were looking forward to very much as well.
Okay, well, don't forget the Jackie Stewart evening on the 5th of December in London. Go to our website, motorsportmagazine.com. That's a special night out with Jackie Stewart. The tickets are cheaper if you're a subscriber, which is good. Anyway, thank you, everybody. Thank you, Damien, Ed, Nigel, and Tiff for coming all the way up to talk to us today. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.